Oliver Tickell. I'm a former editor of The Ecologist, and I even used to write for it back in the old days when it was an actual printed magazine.
Yeah, but the ecologist wasn't just about ecology, was it?
No, it was more about trying to adopt an ecological worldview about, the great issues affecting the world. And it was a very wide-ranging publication, and indeed it still is. It's certainly not something that an academic ecologist would recognize as forming part of their discipline.
Yeah, because the Green Party was originally called the Ecology Party, and there is also this. I mean, I think it was around about a decade ago. I watched this a documentary called Banking Nature, which was all about how new financial systems were the idea, basically, of privatizing nature.
Yes, I think enough said. It seems to me that placing reliance on markets to conserve nature is a pretty dubious track because, I mean, first, there will be elements of nature that are desirable from a commercial standpoint to keep, and then there are those that, frankly, no one's going to care about. And those are often the ones that matter.
Before we look at the geopolitics, Oliver, I'd just like to relate to you because I know, as someone from Oxford, you've had a bit of this yourself. We've got East Bristol Livable Neighbourhoods here, which is quite a lot of central government money coming in to effectively block off people's roads, and put in bus gates where the buses finding it increasingly difficult to actually get down those roads. And in fact, some roads are completely blocked off with planters, and what we're seeing is sort of bus jams with fire engines stuck, having to reverse long distances, putting in one-way streets. The emergency services aren't happy, neither are the local residents with this.
In that case, it sounds like it hasn't been done very well. I think there are two things going on here. One of them is a sort of recognition of the problem of too much traffic and looking at things that can be done about it. And I think that low traffic neighborhoods and so on probably are part of the answer.
I mean, we grew up in low traffic neighborhoods. I mean, it's because everybody used the bus. You look my road in southeast London, a suburban road. You look down the street, there'd be maybe three or four cars at the most in the 1960s.
Well, even when I moved into the street I live in now in 1985, you could look along the length of the street, maybe a couple of 100 meters, and see one or two parked cars. Currently, we are in the era more of parking wars, which has actually been alleviated rather by the area having gone into a controlled parking zone, a CPZ. And interestingly, it turns out that a large number of the people parking here and creating the problems didn't even live here at all.
So why are they parking there?
I don't know, maybe they were coming in from outside and catching the bus, or I don't know. I mean, it's sort of one of those questions that we don't know the answer to. But
Well,
where this
you have to ask
is
them as they get out of their car outside your house, like, why are you here? But
yeah.
there's two things going on here, Oliver. One is the densification of housing. So larger houses being broken up into maybe three or four flats, so there's more potential for the need for a car on the side of the curb. But then it's also been a decimation, certainly here in Bristol, of public transport, with it being very unreliable. Quite often buses just not running at all for, several. And also that you can't actually guarantee you're going to get on the bus if you queue for it. You might find it's full, it sails straight past. There is an awful problem with both public transport cost, reliability, and with the densification of the housing.
Yes, As a historical aside, I'd say that densification of housing is nothing new. It's one of the problems that afflicted the Victorian developers of London who were trying to build these neighborhoods to attract well-off people. But quite often, these neighborhoods built for the rich, actually, the market was swamped. And so the people that ended up living in these big posh houses, even when they were new, were speculative landlords would buy them in order to rent them out to artisans at a relatively low rent on a per room basis. And the whole sort of tone of the neighborhood would go down, and you had this high density housing, which was unplanned. Now, it is not a new thing, and it will probably not ever go away. And in some instances, actually, the turning of houses, which used to be what we would now call HMOs, large HMOs being turned into flats, might actually have lower density housing than what they replaced.
Well, I don't know about that. Here, everything in Bristol is going upwards, a high, very, very high. In fact, the two tallest buildings in Bristol ever have just been built right at the moment for
Yeah,
students.
well, yes. I am generally not very favorably disposed towards very tall buildings. They create a rather alienating environment. And another thing is that they cast a lot of shade. So where you've got tall buildings, it creates a sort of twilight zone down at street level where in winter often sunlight never penetrates. And I think that's the kind of thing that planners often neglect as in their enthusiasm for reaching for the sky.
Anyway, look, we're here really to talk about a bit more geopolitics as the ecologist, the idea was anyway with the ecologist, we've seen over the last few weeks some pretty fearsome warnings from the Russians, haven't we, about the Europeans escalating. We're hearing also about Ukraine apparently is about to join the European Union too.
Well, I think any idea of Ukraine joining the EU has to be taken with a pinch of salt at this moment in time, simply because it just isn't possible. I mean, think of the size of Ukraine and the EU having to pay out its agricultural subsidies over the country of Ukraine.
Yeah, but it's getting smaller, Ukraine, as the Russians advance. But also, I mean, they're already giving lots and lots of money and military support to the Ukrainians.
Yes, certainly the smaller Ukraine gets, the more viable the proposition becomes. And they are indeed giving prodigious amounts of money to Ukraine, supposedly on loan. I don't think any of that money will ever be paid back. So yes, it is. They are throwing in immense amounts of money. Of course, the one thing that we know absolutely for sure with that money is that a large percentage of it will end up in the dollar-denominated bank accounts of the Ukrainian plutocracy, because this is what happens time after time, and it makes you wonder if much of this isn't a huge, great money laundering exercise for the benefit of not only Ukrainian officials and businesses, but with paybacks going back into the European Union itself, because without that, it's really hard to understand their enthusiasm for handing over 100 billion euros for no clear benefit to the EU
Well,
itself.
it might be simply that the money is just a means to an end. The end being they want to extend EU territory. But look, we had last week Anne Keast Butler is not a family name, but she's the Director General of GCHQ. And she was a former head girl at the Perth School for Girls, now Director General of the Signals Intelligence Agency. And she said something quite peculiar, which even the BBC tried their best to politely question. which was that the Russians are going backwards on the battlefield.
Certainly from what I read, that simply isn't true. Any front line is always dynamic. And at any point in time, bits will be advancing, and occasionally Ukraine might launch a surprise counterattack on some weakly defended bit of front and capture territory. So, I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It happened in quite a big way in Kursk, for example. But I think the general picture is that when these big counterattacks take place, bits of territory are seized. It's often at considerable human cost and cost in expensive military equipment. Both of those were certainly the case in Kursk. And that the bigger picture is undisturbed, and that bigger picture is one of incremental Russian advance, like piece by piece on a giant chessboard, and each victory, each taking of land or a strategic village or a section of railway line or canal or road, each one represents another opportunity for the next advance to happen. And it just seems to be evolving that way, piece by piece by piece, that the Russians are advancing. I think that where Ukraine has clearly had successes is with its drone warfare against Russia's petrochemical industry and oil installations and so on. There, I think they certainly can claim success, although in large part, I don't actually think it's really Ukraine's success. I think this is the success of Ukraine's foreign backers, who are providing them with the intelligence and the maps and the targets, and often helping to guide missiles to those targets. It is not necessarily Ukraine that really deserves the credit, so to speak, but certainly it is affecting Russia and its wartime economy and its ability to maintain its pace of oil and related exports. And increasingly, it is looking not only as if a lot of the technology, a lot of the drones themselves, a lot of key components for the drones are coming from the EU nations and, of course, NATO nations. It is actually looking as if the Baltic states are directly firing missiles from NATO territory at Russia and those oil installations. And what we've seen as this war has gone on is an escalating level of aggression from the West. Red lines about no long distance missiles and so on, and about yes, long distance missiles, but they can't be allowed to strike Russian territory. One by one, these red lines that have been imposed have actually fallen away, and it is increasingly turning into a war of NATO against Russia.
Well, over the last few weeks, there's which something that's been really big in the Russian news, hardly featured at all here in the West, in NATO countries. On the 22nd of May, there was a strike in Starobilsk, which is in Lugansk, in the People's Republic of Lugansk, which is part of the area Russians say they've liberated. In fact, the people there did revolt against the Ukraine coup back in the in 2014 to 2013 time. But look, this killed 21 mostly young students at a college, injured 42, and the Russians have been pointing out to the world, although not to here, that these are not combatants, they're kids.
Yes. And it is notable that in a single strike, Ukraine killed 20 plus people who, as you say, were non-combatants. And then you can compare that to Russia's recent strikes on Kiev, which actually it has been reluctant to strike for a long time, but they did actually launch a heavy attack with, I think I read, something like 1,000 drones and ballistic missiles striking targets in Kiev. And what we see there is that most of those hit their targets, and that entire operation of approximately 1,000 drones and other missiles killed roughly 20 people. And so what happens? The Western media jump up and down and they say, this is terrible, this is appalling, this is Russia's attempted genocide of the Ukrainian people. And you think, well, 1,000 missile launches killed roughly the same number of people as a single that single missile launch against Lugansk. And what this tells me is that Russia is actually being incredibly careful not to strike civilian targets, not to hit civilians, and to minimize those civilian losses. All of this is something that seems to be completely lost on the West, whose narratives about Russian aggression and how they're going to kill us all and all of that. I mean, it's the complete inverse of the truth. And anyone who actually stops to think about it will realize, this is just not at all what's happening.
Well, look, Dmitry Medvedev, but this weekend just gone, he's a former president of Russia, quite a prolific Twitterer, if you can call him that, Xer. He says, citizens of EU countries, you should realise your authorities have unilaterally entered into a war with Russia. So be vigilant. Don't be surprised by anything now. The peaceful sleep is over, but you know who to ask why. Now, these are the sorts of threats. The Russians have said for a long time, at some point they will strike back. And what they've also said is it's likely to be completely come out of the blue.
Well, any such attack will always be most successful if it comes as a surprise attack. And in my opinion, Russia has a right in law to strike targets which are directly connected to the war by way of having, for example, factories that are dedicated to the production of arms to send to Ukraine, and launch sites for missiles which are attacking Russia.
But what about a factory, say, that's manufacturing drones that are going both to the British Army, Israel, and Ukraine? Have they got a right to blow one of those up if it's in the UK mainland?
Well, to be honest, I don't think it's going that the Russian attacks would begin on the UK mainland, and I'm not really qualified to judge as to the legality in the kind of general case. But I think that the hostile intent of NATO generally and specific NATO countries, and sad to say Britain is one of them, so is Germany and the Baltic Republics in particular. I think that the combination of the openly aggressive towards Russia rhetoric, the involvement of special forces in Ukraine, the political intent behind it and the actual provision of weapons and the large numbers of them. I mean, in some ways, it is a numbers game. You might have a factory which is legitimately producing weapons for export to various countries. But Ukraine has a need for large numbers of them. And so if you have such a factory and a few missiles here and there going to different countries, actually it's the scale of demand that Ukraine has, which is certainly many hundreds of missiles every day, that demand is likely, in my opinion, to swamp any number of missiles going to any other importing nations. And one thing that one has to remember in international law generally and humanitarian law is the question of proportionality. Is a response proportionate? So if you've got a drone factory or a factory producing engines for drones, and which is sending hundreds of drones to Ukraine on a daily basis, and maybe another 100 more which are being sent somewhere else. Well, I think that on the basis of what is a proportionate response, that yes, that facility could indeed be a completely legitimate target. And it certainly seems strange in a way that it shouldn't be. Another point here is that, frankly, no one seems very bothered about international law anyway. I think that Russia is one of those countries which actually is bothered about international law, and which really does want its responses to be proportionate, and which really is trying quite hard not to hit civilians. But on the NATO side, frankly, there seems to be a complete disregard for international law. And we see this certainly in Israel, and the refusal of Western nations to condemn Israel for what is pretty obviously and transparently horrendous war crimes being committed on a daily basis. You can argue about whether or not it's a genocide, and to me it's pretty obvious it is a genocide, but even if it isn't, there are so many other war crimes that are being committed on a daily basis that the question is kind of irrelevant to this picture of here are these things going on, these terrible, atrocious acts that are going on, and which are essentially uncriticized or receive only the most muted of criticisms from the West. Certainly, Donald Trump is completely indifferent to any questions, not only of international law, but also of national law. You know, some federal judge comes up with a court order saying he must stop doing something, and Trump's like, hey, who's stopping me? He just goes ahead. So we are, it was once said that we are living in a post-truth age, and that's kind of true, but we are also living in a post-law age, in that laws are broken nationally and internationally on a very frequent, indeed a continuous basis. I mean, this whole war in Iran is completely outside any kind of legal framework. It is illegal. No one's bothered. So we have here, I think, Russia trying to adhere to the law, trying to behave in a proportionate manner, but frankly his opponents just aren't. And in the Russian context, I think that the Russian people, as well as the Russian political class and media, are looking at this situation and just thinking it's time we took the gloves off, because the other side, they took their gloves off long ago. We don't even know if they've got any gloves. And here are we trying to to wage war in a proper and proportionate way, and they just don't give a damn.
Well, I mean, I think this is what Medvedev is signalling. He's saying at some point that's going to happen. It's very interesting if you look at the contrast between, say, just Russia and Britain. Britain's leadership is extremely enthusiastic about supporting Ukraine logistically and with intelligence, etc. And the people are not. Most people are the opinion polls say that we shouldn't really be involved at all. And especially when it's when our resources are not being spent here, where we have all sorts of problems of our own. But the opposite is true in Russia, that the leadership are actually much more restrained than the public want, Oliver.
Yes, I think that's exactly it. And meanwhile, we have a leadership which continues with its policies, which frankly no one ever voted for. And opinion polls will show that people recognise the complete insanity of trying to stir up conflict with Russia. Yet we have this sort of deep state, and a deep state which seems to control our politicians rather than the other way round, which is really bent on stirring up conflict.
Okay, so why Russia? Why is it, do you think, the Brits are really so enthusiastic about this proxy war, which has now killed, well, different estimates, but possibly almost 2 million Ukrainians?
Yes, I'd have thought more, because I mean that's a figure that I remember from sort of 6 or 8 months ago, and it's more because Ukrainians continue to be rounded up forcefully on the streets and travelled off to the front, where they have a life expectancy of weeks if they go to the front line. The reason for it, frankly, I find hard to comprehend. But I think that what we have in Britain is a very powerful deep state. And by deep state, I mean embedded structures within the intelligence services, within among senior politicians, among the media, but particularly in the intelligence agencies, which are strongly allied with foreign intelligence agencies, notably those of America and Israel, and that we have here a project which is not really a British project. It is a much wider project, and one that our intelligence services are pursuing with an irrational enthusiasm which is completely disconnected from Britain's national interests.
Well, look, we may not be able to figure out its rationality easily, but surely there are reasons for these things. It's not just totally irrational. There must be some objective.
Well, you say that there must be some objective, but I think that sometimes the ends that are defined can simply acquire their own strength and momentum without having any objective rationalisation
behind
them. Well,
yeah, but they could be negotiating with the Russians quite easily. They've chosen not to.
Yeah, and this is something that goes back a long time. This is not a new thing. And as people have pointed out to me, you know, why did we ever fight the Crimean War? You know, what is this history that Britain has of antagonism towards Russia? And it does go back to the Crimean War. No one now even knows what that war was about. But the British Empire then, as now, somehow saw it as being worth its while to fight a war in actually precisely the same part of the world against Russia. And a war which, I mean, now no one even knows what the Crimean War was about, but I think that it was essentially to control the power, to limit the power of the Russian state of that time, and to limit its ability to threaten the British territories in India and Afghanistan. And it was a sort of a major motive of the British imperial state was to challenge Russia, which it saw as a threat, as the occupier of the great Eurasian continent. And with that sort of rootedness in the Eurasian continent, this huge territorial spread, these massive resources, this huge potential industrial power that we were trying to hold back, and that we essentially saw it as being an imperial rival. And it may be that it simply comes back to exactly that same kind of thinking. Certainly, this is why America, and perhaps not quite as much under Trump as under Biden and Democratic Party administrations, but to them, Russia, through its nature, not because of anything that Russia does, but just because it is so big and has such industrial power and such resources and such extents of farmland and minerals and oil and gas and so on, that underlying unchangeable reality of Russia and the Russian Federation I'm talking about here, its existence is an affront to the imperial ambitions of any other country. And in this case, that means America and that means NATO and that means, in its current incarnation, the European Union as well. The tragedy here is that actually the European Union was doing really quite well, having a de facto economic alliance with Russia, in which we were importing cheap Russian energy and minerals, and we were exporting to them BMW cars, and other manufactured goods and lots of food exports. And really, the economic success for a long time of the European Union was, in my opinion, built on the availability of Russian resources at low prices, which the European Union enjoyed. A major purpose of the 2014 Maidan coup, engineered under a democratic presidency in the United States, a major purpose of that was precisely to rupture that constructive and harmonious relationship between Europe and Russia, which was making Europe rich. And by smashing that relationship, which is exactly what happened following that coup, and then following Russia's final response to the aggression coming to the Russian peoples of the Donbass from Ukraine, armed by NATO, supported by EU countries. The effect of that has been to completely rupture that relationship and to make Europe reliant on American gas and oil and Middle Eastern gas and oil, which is much more expensive, much less secure in terms of supply. And the result is that Europe has become industrially uncompetitive and much poorer.
Yeah, so
So,
it's not about money. It's clearly not about money. It's actually about power and it's about land. But look, back in the 1980s and 90s and the 70s, we had this kind of spy scandal, didn't we? The Cambridge spies, with all these Burgess, MacLean, Guy Burgess, MacLean, Philby, Anthony Blunt. And there are disputes about whether it was Victor Rothschild or possibly Cairn Cross, who was the fifth man. That's still in dispute. But the point here really is that at the end of the Second World War, many Nazis, including SS people, were recruited by the Americans, and maybe these people, rather than being traitors, are just simply recognized that. So what I'm really asking you now, Oliver, is what is the genuine actual American attitude to this? That they were very much involved through Victoria Nuland, etc., and the CIA in starting the war through the Maidan coup in 2014. But now Donald Trump says, oh, he wants nothing to do with it, he wants peace. What's the reality?
Well, I think the reality is that at a certain level, Trump actually does want peace with Russia. He actually would like to have a constructive relationship with Russia. And he would like to have American companies going into Russia and investing there and sending profits back to Wall Street. So that is part of it. But I think there is another aspect of it too, which is that Trump also finds that with his withdrawal, the relative military withdrawal from NATO and all this stuff about how he's not going to be supporting Europe's war in Ukraine, because that is Europe's business. That isn't America's business now, even though America started it. That is Europe's business, and they can pay for it. And so suddenly Trump is finding that all these European countries are willing to stump up prodigious amounts of money to buy American weapons for this war in Ukraine, and indeed to buy American weapons directly to ship to Ukraine. And the EU just stumped up a loan of something like $100 billion for that exact purpose. And so Trump looks at how American arms companies are cleaning up, selling all these weapons to Europe, and he thinks, well, the business is good. And so he is torn between his love of all of this European money coming into America for the war in Ukraine, and the fact that at a certain human level, he actually would like to have peace.
Yeah, well, we've seen the similar sorts of tactics used by the Ukrainians and the Israelis, actually, in both of these, with mass civilian casualties in both by both of these powers. Do you think there's any connection between these two? And obviously, the Ukrainians began as the aggressors, and by moving into the Donbass region against the wishes of the local people, clearly there, and with the Israelis obviously into Gaza and elsewhere, which they've been doing for many decades. So it does seem that there are some similarities with civilian casualties on the one hand, and it seems with the Israelis even particularly targeting journalists and medics too. Which is a new low for humanity, which I don't think we've ever really seen a war like that before, using this technology to do that. So there are some parallels between the tactics used by the Ukrainians, egged on by the Brits and the Americans, and also by the Israelis, who don't seem to be being need to be egged on by anybody. Is there a relation between these two wars, do you think?
Well, I think that we have been brought up, Europeans generally have been brought up, and indeed Americans, to think that we are the ones who are virtuous on the international stage, that we are the ones who believe in and practice human rights. And we certainly have lots of rhetoric about upholding human rights and the laws of war and all this kind of
Well, this
thing.
is going on throughout the centuries of the British Empire too, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, we paint our sepulchres as white as we can, but I think that the underlying reality has always been different, and that terrorism conducted through warfare has always been a key element of the British way of doing things, but not just the British way, the American way as well. I mean, just look at any recent war involving these Western nations. Look at the Vietnam War. I mean, that was a war of mass murder against entire villages. We had to destroy the village to save it, you know, to save the village from communism, and they would kill everybody in it.
Well, look, we can also look at the Second World War with the dilemmas of Bomber Command, as the Germans moved so much of their manufacturing operations underground. Bomber Harris was left with really, I mean, he had a lot of ability to bomb Germany, but he was running out of places where he could actually affect the war effort, and so they started bombing cities.
They did indeed, and I understand that in fact Hitler was trying to persuade Churchill to enter into an agreement not to bomb civilians in their cities, and that it was Churchill who refused and who embarked on the first really big city destroying bombing campaigns. And that this whole targeting of civilians by bombing in the Second World War was in fact very much a British initiative. And certainly what we know of Churchill is that he was completely remorseless in his treatment of native peoples in the colonies, whether it was his readiness to inflict famine in India or his readiness to inspire a lively terror, as he put it, into the tribesmen of Southern Africa by waging aerial warfare against them with machine guns, is that the British Empire was always prepared to use, it doesn't mean it always did use it, but it was always prepared to destroy, to deploy military force as terrorism against these native people, natives of their country. The Korean War was perhaps one of the most utterly horrendous, because what happened there is that as the American bombing campaign against Korea, what is now North Korea, was conducted on such a scale that they ran out of targets to hit, and at one point they declared virtually the entire territory of North Korea, what is now North Korea, as a free fire zone, saying that anyone in that zone, they declared this zone a combat zone, and therefore anyone present in that zone was de facto a combatant and could be bombed. And this meant that there were columns of tens of thousands of civilians fleeing the cities that had been bombed to total destruction. There were tens of thousands of civilians roaming the country, desperately trying to escape from the bombing and find food and water and shelter and all these essential things. And that the American bombers were told to bomb them. And that is exactly what they did, because they were deemed to be combatants by virtue of where they were.
I go back to what I was saying about the Cambridge spies. They must have looked at all of this, but especially someone, you know, people who were working in the intelligence services would have been seeing what the Americans were up to after World War II in the 50s and 60s and thinking, actually, you know, we see the Soviet Union as a far more sensible, like these are the men in the room, that the Americans are basket cases.
Well, I think that has to be the case, because I mean, without claiming that the Soviet Union was an altogether benign power, because it certainly wasn't. If you just look at the scale of atrocities being committed by the Western powers, I mean, it's really beyond imagination. And it continues to be now in Israel, in Gaza, in the West Bank. in Lebanon, in Iran. A core modus operandi that we see being deployed is the mass murder of civilians who are up against the most powerful, sophisticated, destructive weaponry that the world is capable of.
Yeah, and technologically very advanced with targeting systems which are get becoming AI basically.
Yes, and where you can turn a virtual knob to turn up and down the discriminatoriness of the AI system in terms of the probabilities that something is a military target that it's looking for. You know, if you want to inflict mass damage and you say, right, well, we will hit any target that is, say, 80% certain to be a military target, that this is actually a Hamas combatant, for example. And then they find, oh, well, we've got it set at 80%, but at 80%, we aren't really sort of having very much impact. So we have to turn that down. And eventually, they're sort of turning it down to about 10%. And saying that on a 10% chance that someone is a Hamas combatant, that is sufficient to justify launching an attack.
Amazing. Well, look,
But
let's just get up to date. This week we've had Ukrainian drones hitting St. Petersburg as Putin's flagship economic forum opens. This is what is known as Russia's Davos. And I wonder, you know, it seems to me to that there are different economic models developing, a St. Petersburg model and a Davos model that are behind much of the conflicts that we're seeing. And at that, so that's one question, which is this is you know what is happening actually at the moment with economics with the BRICS countries, particularly opposed to the IMF way of doing things, and so we're looking at sort of financial institution wars in a way as well. See, economic warfare is a big part of all of this, as you were saying earlier, to do with energy in Europe, etc. But then today, that is well, this is Thursday. World War III fears. I mean, it is the Daily Express, which is uses quite flowery language, but Putin's crony issues chilling nukes warning. It would be a good scenario, he says. Vladimir Putin's friends are chillingly threatening a war lasting 20 years in which the use of nuclear weapons may be a good scenario. This vision of the future came at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, known as the Russian Davos, which was hit a day earlier, as I said, by Ukrainian drone strikes. Not the conference, they hit an oil refinery and nobody was killed, thankfully. And the naval base too. So the Putin's friend, he's used the forum to set out an apocalyptic non-stop war scenario fueled by Russia being over-colonized by the West. Oligarch and Putin friend Konstantin Malofiev, that's Malofev, a major pro-Kremlin media owner, told the forum the use of nuclear weapons, we don't consider it a worst-case scenario now.
Yes, well, I don't think you can have a 20-year war and a war involving nuclear weapons. Because if you have a war involving nuclear weapons, it'll be over in a matter of about a day or two. But one thing that I don't expect the Daily Telegraph ever told us was about Kaja Kallas's proposing, and and this was a public pronouncement.
So who is she?
She is the EU's foreign policy suprema, who speaks for the EU on foreign policy affairs.
Right, so she's like the Europe's foreign minister.
Yes.
I mean, because we have to, I think of the European Union as a country. You know, when I buy something, it doesn't say made in Germany, made in France, or anything. It says made in the EU.
Yes. So she is the effective foreign minister. And what she was saying was that she thought it would be a good thing to break up the Russian Federation into its constituent republics. In other words, to bring an end to the Russian Federation. And either she has no idea, I mean, either she has no idea of just how inflammatory comments like this are, or she was deliberately trying to stir up trouble. And I honestly don't know which it is. But this idea that America or NATO should break up the Soviet Union into, say, a dozen or so separate republics. This is something that was put forward in a Rand Corporation report, and the Rand Corporation is essentially a wholly owned subsidiary of the American Department of War or Defense, as it once was. And it is something that certainly Russia took very close note of, because this is effectively threatening the existence of the state of the Russian Federation. And that is a big deal. That is a very big deal to effectively tell a country that you want to break it up, to force its breakup into its constituent parts.
Well, look, I know Henry Kissinger I was never a great fan of, but I almost wish he was back with us, because he made it absolutely clear to anyone that would listen, which was actually quite a lot of very serious politicians around the world, and people in think tanks, etc., that you can do what you want pretty much in foreign policy, but don't mess with nuclear superpowers. Keep well away.
Yeah, and Henry Kissinger also spoke very good sense on the subject of the potential weaponization of Ukraine against Russia. And very simply, he said, do not do it. This is madness, because the nature of Ukraine itself is that it has a west which looks to the west, and it has an east that looks to the east. And in that sense, it is a highly fractured country. There is a modus vivendi, as long as you just keep the balance, which actually for quite a long time it did keep. But if you start coming down on the Western side and having coups and weaponizing it against Russia, then the result will be war. And he saw it as being a civil war, and in fact, there was for a while the civil war, but it is that civil war is now growing into a war between Russia and NATO. To Kissinger, it was clear and obvious that this was the outcome of the way that the West's policies were developing, and he warned against it, and he was absolutely right to do so. But certainly in Russia, this idea that NATO can just come along and break up the Russian Federation, that is total anathema to most Russian people. And if you want to know why, you can just look at what the West did, and America in particular, did to the former Yugoslavia. Because Yugoslavia was the richest and most successful of the socialist countries anywhere in the world, and Yugoslavia has now been subject to that dismemberment process at the hands, primarily but not entirely, of the Americans. Germany also played quite a big part in that. It has been dismembered into statelets, which are now open to exploitation, And easily subjugated because there is no power there that is in any way capable of standing up to the political or economic clout of the EU or NATO or America. But if you remember the whole breakup of Yugoslavia, it was an amazingly painful process, and it involved the killing of huge numbers of people. It involved total turmoil. It involved civil wars. It involved massive ethnic and religious hatred. And so when Russians look at what that policy, exactly the policy that NATO and America, and now it turns out the EU, has in mind for Russia, that policy of breaking up, and they look at what it was like in Yugoslavia, and they just think, no way are we letting that happen to us. And the Russian people are absolutely ready for a war, and very likely a nuclear war, to stop that happening. And I think that the West has sort of lulled itself into a state of complacency because, all right, yes, Russia's this big nuclear power and it's got 10,000 nuclear missiles or whatever, and but hey, they're just a paper tiger. They never really did anything. They've had these red lines, and look, we've trampled over them, and not much has happened. But I think that is a completely false sense of security, because if Russia ever feels that its existence as a nation is actually prejudiced by NATO, it will use nuclear
Well,
weapons.
and there's another reason that they might decide to do something, and that is, as is happening actually at the moment in Russia, is Putin's political support. I mean, he's had a restraining hand on much of this, but there are politically in Russia forces at work which the people are beginning to support, which are saying, no, it's time to strike back against. So that there's a political angle to this too. But I mean, if the Russians do, as they are now quite openly saying, as Medvedev is saying and others, we're going to hit you back at some point. So just remember that. And when we do, it might be a big surprise, but remember who's responsible for it. Whereabouts do you think they are most likely to hit? They've talked about the use of intelligence and also about manufacturing equipment and also firing equipment into Russia. So as you said, they've crossed all these red lines bit by bit. They've been sending their own troops in clandestinely into Ukraine. They've been sending in equipment. They've been passing on intelligence. So where might be some part of NATO that the Russians might strike?
Well, I think that the Baltic republics are quite vulnerable because they do seem to have been actually sending missiles at Russia. So the Baltic republics should be considered
Well,
vulnerable.
yeah, because we've got British salt, we've got British troops out there all around, haven't we? And we just had the Defence Secretary paid a visit to, I think it was Estonia.
And those British troops themselves could be vulnerable, and certainly they're a military target, aren't they? You can't complain about them not being a military target. I think Russia would want to draw together all its intelligence as to exactly where these missiles are coming from, but I think that having actually got a very clear picture of where those missiles are coming from, and it may actually have that picture already, I think that it might very well want to strike those locations. There are
Aren't
probably
there
locations.
elements? Aren't there elements in NATO? They're actually itching for this as well because they want the excuse to say, "Oh, look, Russia's now attacked us. We're at war with them."
Well, there are, though, frankly, I can't imagine who they are, just because Europe is in no state to go to war against Russia, and this is why it
Well,
just seems
Rutte, Stoltenberg, these people are, and actually. In Callas, etc., they do seem to be hinting that this is where they're going.
yes, and what they're doing is they are saying that this is the sort of 15 or 20-year project, to get ready for war against Russia. They aren't saying that they want to do that immediately, but they're saying that they want to build up, wartime economies and build up weapons manufacturing and ammunition and so on, so as to be able to take on Russia in a war. Now, if I was Russia, I would take this as meaning, if we let them do this, if we give them the time to build up these armies and weapons and so on, then actually we really will have a problem in 15-year time, in 15 years' time. Another thing here is that Russia at the moment has a significant military advantage in terms of its missile capability. It has an unrivaled advantage in its hypersonic ballistic missiles,
Well,
for example.
this is like the opposite of the 1960s missile gap, where the Americans were worried that the Russians were catching up with their ballistic missiles.
Yeah, so I think that now it's Russia that has the advantage, but it is looking at America, which is aggressively pursuing its own hypersonic missile programs. It is looking at a Europe which is determined to rearm in order to be able to go to war on Russia in the future. And if I was Vladimir Putin looking at this, I would think, well, actually, I need to have this war now, or if not now, soon. So that we can use our superior missile capabilities against NATO, rather than waiting for them to catch up, and the whole thing would be much worse and put them in a position of being able to attack us. So all of these things, if I was in the position of Vladimir Putin, I would be thinking that I actually need to stamp out this threat before it grows, before they are in a position to annihilate us.
Well, maybe this is exactly what Medvedev is channeling when he says, "Be prepared for surprises." Anyway, look, Oliver, I wonder if we could just finish with a completely different, although it's a related subject, which is the UK housing crisis. I mean, we did talk a bit at the beginning about these massive student blocks, etc., but we are finding in Britain these days that rents and mortgages are so high, housing is so difficult to find. That many people are being persuaded, really, through unemployment, etc. Obviously, they're going to have to be claiming benefits, and then they find if they do work, they're losing those benefits. There does seem to be a real serious problem with housing in the country. We in Bristol here we're witnessing much of the traveller community that's been in the city for decades, probably hundreds of years, actually. Being forced out of the city now, and by the council. So even for those that just simply desperate for a roof over their head, I mean, some of the van dwellers here, they say, "Well, at least I'm on the ladder because I'm in a vehicle, I'm in a caravan."
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I never understood, if we go back to when quantitative easing was taking place after the financial crash, what basically happened was that a huge amount of money was wiped out, remembering that the whole system of money supply is essentially money creation out of thin air by banks and provided through credit.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind one of those licenses
And
to print money myself.
that,
I wouldn't mind one of those licenses to print money
pardon?
myself.
Well, it comes at a cost, which is that it certainly comes at a big cost to society, which is that interest has to be paid on that money. So it doesn't come free. The banks create this money. When they create this money, they also create a liability for themselves. So if that money isn't paid back, they go bust. When that financial crisis happened, a huge amount of money was simply wiped out of the existence. And so the Bank of England began its quantitative easing program to reintroduce money into the economy. What I think the huge tragedy is for Britain, for the people, for the economy, and for our whole experience of life was the way in which they chose to do it. Because they chose to do it by essentially lending at just about zero interest rates to very rich people who then use that money to do things like buy property, speculate on commodities, all at very low risk and not and having to pay very little, if any, interest on the money that they were borrowing. And this then led to huge asset price inflation. This is what was feeding, at the same time as the economy was incredibly weak, the price of housing kept on going up and up. And it's because this money was just being lent out. To so that people that had access to it could buy up property on the cheap and then watch the price going up. That was the choice that was made. It is dressed up as if it was a technical choice, but it was not a technical choice. The technical thing was pumping money into the economy, and there were completely different ways in which it could have been done, which could have had completely different outcomes. And one of those ways in which it could have been done is that this money could have been used to finance housing corporations. When I say housing corporations, I mean publicly owned bodies tasked with the building of housing. And with the building of housing and the rental of housing at moderate rates to the great population of Britain. And that could have been done. And it would have had completely out different outcomes because we put out all this money on quantitative easing, but we got nothing for it. If it had gone into public housing corporations, then it could have built all the housing that Britain needed as a nation. It would have employed enormous numbers of people. We could have had apprenticeships programs so that more and more people developed the skills that they needed. We could have had huge insulation programs on housing, and not just on housing, also in industry and offices, retrofitting buildings to be energy efficient, reducing our dependence on imported oil and gas. We could have had renewable energy corporations, once again, publicly owned, building out renewable energy and displacing oil and gas and coal from the grid and making Britain reliant not on imported foreign energy, but on our own native homegrown renewable energy. We could have done all of those things, and had that been done, Britain today would be a completely different place. We would have abundant housing, and we wouldn't just have abundant housing, we would have a housing industry that was still working and still building housing for people. We would not be paying through the nose for fossil fuel energy. From war-torn parts of the world, we would be depending on our own renewable energy.
Well, look, it's one thing to look back and look at what we did wrong. What we should we do right now, do you think, to
Well,
fix the housing crisis?
we should essentially do that same thing. We had an amazing opportunity to do it then. Because of that need to pump money into the economy, and that's what we could have done. But we still need all those things. And if we can find unlimited billions of pounds, or indeed trillions, for rearmament against a Russia that has, frankly, no designs on us whatsoever, apart from just wanting to defend itself from our aggression, then we can use that money to build up the goods and services that we desperately need here. And
Now, look, one thing is
the
that we
most
don't hear much
important one.
about Oliver, one thing we don't hear much about nowadays is landlessness. So many young people they're now saying, well, it looks like I'll never be able to buy a home. And this does kind of put you on the back foot. You are then absolutely 100% reliant on the economic system, on money rather than, land and natural resources.
Yes. I mean, I think Britain has actually long been a country where we have been reliant on the global agricultural system to produce our food, and on I industries to produce our goods. But I think that the degree of that reliance has only increased. And part of why it's increased is that fewer and fewer people have the skills needed for any level of self-reliance, whether it's mending a bicycle or growing your own food. And certainly, if you've got no land, no access to land on which you can grow your food, that is a big obstruction. But I think that no less of an obstruction is a de-skilling of the people of Britain to allow them to do things for
Yeah,
themselves,
that's
whether
I
it's
think that's deliberate. I mean, I think it's absolutely obviously deliberate. You're right. I mean, in France, for example, you've got a much greater knowledge of the countryside from the rural population there than you do here, won't we? Because maybe because the Industrial Revolution brought such mass urbanisation in Britain that we've kind of forgotten. Because as our cities die and industry collapses, it would seem to make sense to actually make use of these vast, vast empty acres for nice settlements, communities, new villages, etc. But it would be very pleasant places to live. But it seems that the opposite is the case. We're being sort of cooped up in cities, Oliver. Anyway, maybe that's a discussion for another time. But I just wondered finally on the main topic here, which has been Russia and Ukraine. They have these firewalls up these days, so you're not supposed to be able to access Russia Today, which was on our TV screens for many years, and Sputnik and the other official Russian outlets. So whereabouts is a good place you think is reasonably easy to get some unbiased news about what's happening, considering the brinksmanship which our so-called leaders seem to be pushing with the Ukrainian, and Russia.
sources of information. Well, there's a lot of good stuff on Twitter. There's a lot of good stuff on Telegram. Actually, there's still quite a lot of good stuff on Facebook. And even though these media are almost certainly to some extent clamping down on dissident opinions, they aren't doing so in any complete or encompassing way. And the existence of social media has opened up, this sort of treasure trove of a cornucopia of information. And once you start finding it, what you realize is that actually there's so much of it that you can't keep up. But we are no longer dependent on the legacy media, the principal broadcasters and newspapers. There is so much more out there, and we do still have the freedom, if we are prepared to do a bit of work and look for it and find the people that we want to follow. The social media are actually opening that world up, and
Well, yeah, but the trouble is,
we
it's rather like what you were saying earlier about the AI in Gaza, etc. Is that once you're on these social media platforms, all that your Elon Musks, your Mark Zuckerbergs, etc., have to do is press a little button, and all of those dissident voices are either banned or just reduced to being shadow banned, and so no one sees it.
Yep, but once you find the people that you want to follow, you can actually go to them and
Unless they're banned. I mean, I think that's Quite potentially,
Well,
why we've been herded into this social media world is it's actually really rather easy in the future, much easier to censor than in the old days the mainstream news was.
Well, I'm not saying that a degree of encompassing and inescapable censorship may not yet take place, because it might, but it isn't there now.
No, you're quite right. Anyway, what I'd like to do at some future point, Oliver, is just to look at this possibility of Britain actually coming successfully out of this post-industrial world and creating decent places to live around the country rather than trying to coop everybody up in cities. But for the meantime, that'll do for now. Oliver Tickell, thanks very much.
Thank you, Tony.